we'll move on to case number three, which is Johnson against Cambridge Industries. Or really, I should say perhaps Meridian.
May it please the court. This case is like the case of Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing, in which the district court ignored important evidence. Sanderson Plumbing, or Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing, held that the court must consider all of the evidence and consider all of the evidence together and not consider evidence isolated. The first example of the evidence that was ignored by the court was the admission of the defendant that Josh Goad was later promoted to the position of team leader. There was just no discussion of it by the court, and the court just ignored it.
Does the evidence show whether Mr. Goad applied for that position or whether it just came down from the sky or anything?
The evidence does not definitively show that. However, the exhibit of the defendant indicates that it was really up to Mr. Goad, because defendant's appendix 15 says Josh is very knowledgeable of most product lines. I depend on him daily to assist in problem product areas, assisting the manager, the production manager, is what the team leaders do. So if Josh desires, he should be considered as leadership material. That was in November of 1999, in the fall of 99, when the other team leader, Eric Williams, and the plaintiff observed Mr. Goad performing those duties.
But is that all you have on whether he... The reason I'm asking, of course, is because your opponents point to the fact that Mr. Johnson never did apply. After the two positions are eliminated, and for whatever reason, we can get into that, but they're gone. So both Mr. Goad and Mr. Johnson lose that opportunity. And then later on, according to this admission that you're relying on, Mr. Goad does become a team leader. If he applied and became a team leader and Mr. Johnson never applied, that looks different from somebody reaching out and saying, we're going to tap you to be team leader.
Yes, and that would be a legitimate, independent, non-discriminatory reason.
Right.
And that was never offered. It was never said that Mr. Goad applied. There was no evidence Mr. Goad applied, Mr. Goad ever had to apply. The defendant's evidence actually was in favor of us, saying that if he desires, he should be considered for
Doesn't that mean he's got to at least indicate a desire?
Well, both of the
I suppose the evidence shows your client did not apply. He became fed up with the situation.
There was no posting. I mean, there's no evidence of any posting of any application by anyone. And both of them had gone through the application process and been selected
right,
by the employees. So there was no later issue of an application or a posting or anything like that. Now, the defendant did say, well, there's no evidence that he applied. Well, that was never raised as a defense or legitimate reason by the defendant that anybody had to apply or that there was any posting, which gets into
that. Does that have to be part of the admission, or is that an affirmative defense? You
know? Actually, the admission.
The admission
resolves the issue.
The admission doesn't go into any detail at all, right, about what this. It just says here's the situation as of whenever the thing happened.
Right.
But we don't know a thing about the circumstances now.
Well, the admission.
Should we look to the defendant to provide all those, or who's got the burden at that point?
Well, number one, the court ruled that Josh Goad was not promoted. Mm-hmm. And that flies in the face of the admission that he was promoted. Now, that admission ends that issue, and that the court was wrong in ignoring that admission. You're raising a second issue of, okay, Josh, we agree that there's an admission that Josh Goad was promoted. What about this issue of who applied and was it posted or what? And that, then, is the issue that has been raised after the decision, which the court didn't even rely on, There was no offer in the district court that it was posted or that anybody had to apply a second time, just after they'd applied 6 months earlier. But that gets into the second issue, that where the court ignored the evidence. And that was that the court said, well, the plaintiff has not proven pretext of a reason, and yet no reason was offered by the defendant. The defendant only said...
Are we talking about the race discrimination case or the retaliation case at this point?
They are parallel in that the race discrimination started with the racial comments in May of 1999. Then when both of the people who complained, both white and black, Josh Goad and Daryl Johnson, supported by others, including Eric Williams, were complained to the company that racial comments were being made, then the company, in response, took away the promotions that had just been given to these two people who had complained to Eric Williams and to the plant manager.
Well, there's
so that started the retaliation.
There's a temporal sequence. I mean, the company also appears to have disciplined one of the people at a minimum of a one-day, with a one-day suspension, and for reasons which may or may not have anything to do with this, the other one leaves the workforce. So the company, in an immediate response to the complaint about the coworker inappropriate statements, does something. Then we have this temporal sequence of this mysterious decision from corporate to eliminate the team leader positions, and that's where Judge Barker said to you, okay, I'll, you know, taking those facts in the light most favorable to you, I'll assume you have your prima facie case on retaliation for that, but then she finds no pretext.
Correct.
Right.
Mostly correct, at least. There are some clarifications I'd like to make, and that is that the most immediate action that the company took was to take away the team leader positions from the two who had complained about it and about the racial discrimination. Now that is what is so terrible. Disciplining one of the men who said a racial statement is not terrible, of course. What we point out is that they said they disciplined him for 3 days, and they actually didn't. They let him stay, and then they promoted him later. But that's a small issue. The big issue is that they took away, in response, they took away the positions from the two who had complained. Now, Josh Goad wised up, the white guy, and didn't complain anymore about race discrimination.
But could we pause? Because there, what Judge Barker says anyway is, at that point, you had your prima facie case on retaliation. You've got the two of them who complained, losing these positions, whatever they may be, as team leader. And then the company comes forward and says, we just decided we didn't want this position right then. That's the kind of legitimate non-discriminatory reason that the companies give. And that, at that point, you've got to come up with something.
They gave no reason why they changed their mind.
But do they have to?
Yes, because there would be nothing to rebut.
So you would say that if they had said, we just thought these positions were redundant, or we've decided not to have as many team leaders anymore, or it was a change to organizational philosophy, if they had said any of those things, you would have a different case?
We would have something to rebut, and then we could then talk about the need for team leaders or whatever. But they never said there's no need for team leaders. They never said anything. The inference was that the reason they changed their mind, the most logical inference, was that it was because these two employees complained about race discrimination.
Well, they never say that, right? I mean, they say...
No, defendants will never admit.
...came down from corporate, you know, actually according to your client, hearsay, your client says that somebody said that the corporate people said...
Right. And so when we have... As a matter of fact, this is a very important point on the law, of course, as to the who has the burden, you ask. The defendant has the initial burden of production of a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason. Now, that ordinarily, the first element, of course, is to state what that reason is. Why they changed their mind was never stated.
Well, they did that. They gave you a reason.
No, they just said they changed their mind.
It wasn't as elaborate a reason as you would have liked, but it was a reason.
No, they just said they changed their mind. They did not say why.
Did you depose the plant manager?
No, he is no longer even in the area or working for the company. And
well, I mean,
So,
so you could depose somebody as to what the reasons were for this.
Yes, that is what the employer suggested, that we depose him and depose somebody else and depose somebody else until someone comes up with a reason.
So why do you suggest interrogatories? You know, who in the chain of command was responsible for the decision to eliminate the team leader position?
Well,
don't ask for names.
Well, first of all, that's placing the burden on us to seek out the names and the reasons.
Well, I think that's the essential question here. Is
and
who
first
has
of all,
the burden? And I'm,
right,
I'm not
and
sure
burden
I understand
production.
Why it's not your burden.
Well, the case law up into Reeves says it's not our burden of production to seek out evidence as to what the reason is and who the decision maker is and what knowledge he has. Ordinarily,
well, isn't the issue how detailed a reason do we get?
Ordinarily, number one, you have a reason for a change of mind. I mean, instead of someone just saying, well, I changed my mind, which indicates that it's because of retaliation, they would say, because, as Judge Wood said, any number of reasons, which we could then try to rebut.
But they give you the reason. They say a change of mind. So don't they meet their burden by saying change of mind, and then the burden shifts to you to get more detail if you want more detail? I mean, that's really what
it
boils
down. No, because change of mind or can mean change of mind because of the retaliation.
Oh, I understand.
We changed
that.
Our mind because we wanted to retaliate.
Yeah,
no one's going to say that.
But they give you just a bare bones reason. Okay. But doesn't the burden shift to you to get behind that bare bones?
No, Your Honor, because that is not a legitimate reason. Changing the mind because of retaliation is not
well,
a legitimate reason.
I know it's not because of retaliation, but they didn't say it was because of retaliation. They just said change of mind.
Right.
I'm saying, doesn't that meet their burden? It is
no,
very, very broad. It doesn't give you any of the rationale, but haven't they met their burden, and
no,
then it's up to you to get more?
Because that is not non-discriminatory. It includes retaliation.
Well,
it has to be
was,
non-discriminatory.
I don't think the word policy was used, but the implication is that the policy on this issue has changed. We're not going to have team leaders anymore. Isn't that what they said?
No, they didn't say anything like that. They just said, we changed our mind. We decided we're going to just have the same team leaders we had before. This is after posting it, taking applications, having an election of, and then when
the plant manager said something that to that effect, that they're not going to have team leaders anymore, period.
Well,
that's
and then
change of policy.
And then later they put Josh Goad in those duties and say that he is assisting the manager.
Well, we don't have any idea why he got put back in those duties. I mean, all we have is a bare-bones admission of something.
Well, it shows that they were using someone in the team leader position, and they admitted that on the motion for summary judgment. So there has to be a minimum of a reason, which is non-discriminatory, not we changed our mind, which would include retaliation, but some other non-discriminatory reason, as Judge Wood said, something that we could deal with. And then you propose, well, you could go out and search for a reason. You could depose this person and this person. You could ask some interrogatories. You could chase around asking a reason. And the law says that is not proper. It's the defendant who, if there is a non-discriminatory reason, as Judge Wood proposed, has to come forward and say, this is the reason. And furthermore, all of the cases, I'm not sure there's any case that says it's absolutely required, but most of the cases say, and this person is the one who made this decision of this non-discriminatory reason, and then a lot of the cases go forward as to whether he had knowledge or didn't have knowledge or whatever.
Just
and that's
to
proposed
caution
by
you,
the defendant.
You're kind of eating up your rebuttal time if you want to save anything.
Okay. I'm glad you asked because that's very important. If plaintiffs just have to chase around ghosts when there's no non-discriminatory reason, then it would be impossible. There, after this, the action taken by the employer was to give harder jobs to the black employees and to segregate them to work together, usually. Then the employer said, well, Daryl Johnson implies that he requested it. He never requested harder jobs. Never, on the contrary, he wanted to be the team leader that had the easier job. He requested assistance and they denied it. He got the job done and they didn't require the white employees to do it. The white employees would just loaf until they assigned the black employee to do it. He got the job done then. Then after the harder jobs and the segregation of the black employees, then they have this horrendous notification which refers directly to the complaints of Mr. Johnson over a 9-month period. I'll say whatever I've got.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Garth. Mr. Rector?
Thank you. May it please the court, Brent Rector on behalf of Meridian. First, the inconsistencies in the statement of material facts and replies. These statements were made not as admissions under the discovery rules. They were part of the district court's procedure for summary judgment. It was a local rule of the Southern District of Illinois.
But we can't really resolve inconsistencies within that on a summary judgment posture. Don't we have to take the version that, if believed by a trier of fact, is the one most favorable to Mr. Johnson?
No, it's really, the local rule is really a rule of convenience to see where there are inconsistencies and inconsistencies of facts. And it's just, in fact, the case of Borky versus Maytag, a case that I've cited in my brief on another topic, talked about how the local rule of, I think it was the district court in Southern Illinois, a similar rule, was that kind of rule is an organizational tool for the district court to identify quickly where there are disputes of fact, but where there is a potential dispute of fact, the court has to go to the evidence, depositions,
mean,
and so forth.
When Meridian, this is page 834 of the blue brief, when Meridian says, solely for the purpose of this motion, Meridian will admit this fact exists without controversy, that being the fact that in the fall of 1999, Josh Goad was given the job of team leader, I just have problems on a summary judgment posture. I would never in a million years think that precluded you from trying to prove the contrary at a trial, but for summary judgment, it seems to me you're stuck with that.
Not if it's inconsistent with another part of the same set of admissions. And
why?
If you look back,
why do we take that favorably to you as opposed to Mr. Johnson? Why do we resolve inconsistencies within your own responses in a way favorably to you?
Well, it was the job of the district court to interpret and apply its local rule, and the district court did not focus on what Mr. Johnson has raised here on appeal, but the district court did take a look at the underlying evidence after having used its local rule to try to identify where there were conflicts and facts, and then use the evidence that was in the record on this subject rather than the convenience rule.
It's not supposed to resolve evidentiary questions on summary judgment.
Well,
Cambridge/Meridian uses a job title called team leader.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Does the company use the job title team leader?
It has, yes.
In fact,
Eric Williams, I believe, a black employee at the facility, was already a team leader and was one of those people who reported the earlier racial statement by the fellow employees to human resources officer at the plant.
Okay, so if this, I take it then your position has been, if this employee performance evaluation that you appended to your brief, if Josh Goad had been a team leader, his classification would have shown up as team leader instead of production associate?
Yes, and also it shows at the bottom he's a production associate, and it says that he is ripe for promotion if he wants to be promoted.
It doesn't tell you what,
but he's promotion material, and so there's evidence that he was not, in fact, promoted. Keep in mind that under the Borky decision, the decision whether to apply a local rule strictly or not is within the district court's discretion.
Yeah, but then summary judgment review is de novo, so for us to look at the...
Right, that was my question.
I
don't see how the local rule trumps the type of review we're supposed to do and how you can have this inconsistency and take these inconsistent positions and that not be sufficient enough to send this to the jury for trial. I understand that the procedures of the district court there and how that may help make things efficient and how it may bring to a head what the issues are, but with the inconsistencies in the pleadings and in these in the statement of fact number 102 and 195, I don't see how the local rule saves you.
Well, it's ultimately, the job of the district court and in de novo review here under Rule 56 to determine what is the evidence, okay? And if you wanted to use the district court rule to try to sort things out in terms of where there are disputes of fact and where there are not, then you go to the actual evidence, the depositions. And in the depositions, he never said that Josh Goad was promoted to team leader. He only said that he saw, this is the plaintiff's deposition, he saw him acting as a team leader, doing the job of a team leader. If you look at another a piece of evidence that was in the record before the district court, which is the organizational chart, I believe it's in my brief, appendix 812 or 815. It shows all of those people listed as production associates, even Eric Williams, who was a team leader. This is not something that was...
Well, that's why I asked my other question. Yeah. I wonder if you could address the question whether if we don't agree with you and we think that 102 means we've got to approach this case as though Josh Goad was made team leader in the fall, what impact does that have on your position?
Nothing, Your Honor. It was not a material adverse employment consequence, even if Josh Goad was acting as a team leader. A team leader, according to the evidence from Daryl Johnson's own deposition, was someone who works with production associates, acts as a production associate doing those jobs. He just isn't assigned a regular job, but it's sort of a helper, okay? But he is not the kind of work that Mr. Johnson's claims he saw Mr. Goad doing doesn't mean that there was any change of pay or other benefits or hours. And as this court has said in repeated number of cases, you have to have something significant to be a material adverse employment consequence.
And so a team leader does not get different pay, doesn't have different hours, doesn't get different benefits. Is that what you're saying?
Josh, there's no evidence that Josh Goad ever got a change in pay in the fall of 1999, which is when he was alleged by plaintiff to have become a team leader.
Let's assume that he was a team leader. That when you become a team leader, you get better salary, you get more benefits. Is that what you're saying?
If no different benefits, there.
But salary would be.
If you actually were appointed a team leader and you were designated as such, okay. But acting like a helper, okay, that's what they really said they saw.
But team leaders do make more money. That
if you actually are a team leader, there is an increase in pay under Cambridge's policy.
Okay.
So why don't you
have any team leaders on this Rushville organizational chart then?
They are all listed as production associates. Team leader was a designation for a few of the employees, okay? But they're all production associates. And to finish the question...
So Aaron Goad might have been a team leader even though his form says production associate,
no.
The exact opposite.
No. There would have been some documentation of a change of pay form. In discovery, there was a Josh Goad personnel file was produced. There's nothing in the record from that was produced by plaintiff to show that there was ever a change of status to show a pay change for Josh Goad anytime after May 1999. So there never was a pay change for Josh Goad. What you heard the plaintiff testifying and Mr. Darst describing here was that the perception of plaintiff and Eric Williams in his affidavit, that they saw Josh Goad acting as a team leader, which means doing helping work. They never said that there was a pay change, and so there was never a material adverse employment consequence in the period of time after May 1999.
So even if he was, quote, acting as a team leader, you're saying the plaintiff wouldn't have any claim. I mean, the plaintiff could argue that, you know, the plaintiff could also argue that he never got the actual, quote, he was never anointed team leader, but in actuality he did the work of a team leader, and so he actually got the promotion, but only, you know, without the formal title, and the company did that to avoid the issue that had been raised with Johnson.
But that would not have been a material adverse employment consequence, because there was, what was material about, you know, if in fact that's the case, and you take it in the light most favorable to plaintiff at this stage, what was material adverse about job assignments? There are several Seventh Circuit cases that say that mere changes in job assignments, like changes in shift, changes in location, changes in territory for salespeople, are not material adverse employment consequences within the same classification. and this production associate was all the same classification.
Was the team leader, was that a Cambridge concept that Meridian had mixed feelings about going along with it?
Well, the
might
the,
want to
the
phase
change,
out or something.
The change that we're talking about, Your Honor, was from Cambridge management, you know, not to have more team leaders. That was something that happened under Cambridge. There is no evidence in the record about what happened with Meridian because all of the allegations are against Cambridge. Meridian is only here because of the successorship rules of Title VII. We're not here because of any allegations of conduct or misconduct or discrimination or retaliation by Meridian. And that was, it was the evidence at the that was at the district court was that from Mr. Johnson himself in his deposition. He was told at the time in May 1999 that corporate decided. It wasn't as if we decided, okay? He was told by the acting plant manager, Ron Sadlowski, that corporate decided there'll be no team, more team leaders.
But you know, that's really vague because Mr. Sadlowski says that according to Mr. Johnson. And then you, without even coming forward with anything on your own, saying, yes, this was a headquarters decision in the Human Resources Department or wherever they make such decisions at Cambridge, nothing. I mean, you rest entirely on Mr. Johnson's account of what Mr. Sadlowski said somebody else told him, which strikes me, no matter how diluted you think Burdine and St. Mary's and all these cases have made the responsibility to come forward with a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, this is pretty diluted. And the other thing that Mr. Darst is arguing is if you suggest a reason that has within it two subsets, subset one, discrimination, subset two, non-discrimination, you haven't really offered the non-discriminatory reason that we're looking for.
There are a whole host of legitimate non-discriminatory reasons that may have within it some element of potential pretext. The cases that you've listed on the shifting burden under McDonnell Douglas all say that the proof of pretext, the burden on pretext, is the plaintiff's.
But it doesn't arise until the defendant has met a production burden.
And we have. The deposition of Daryl Johnson itself, he said he was told by Ron Sadlowski that corporate decided there won't be any more team leaders. And
but who's corporate? Why isn't Ron Sadlowski himself corporate?
He was an acting plant manager, and this is a
that
large company with a multiple
corporate
number of plants.
He's never deposed or never.
No, he was not deposed.
Any evidence about this point?
He was not. He was not deposed, and that statement itself would be an admission by Cambridge, now potentially binding on Meridian as to what their reason was, and if plaintiff had some concern with that being pretext, he could have done what you've suggested, asked interrogatories, deposed. There was never ever any attempt to try to find Mr. Sadlowski to find out that. They could have taken a 30B6 to find out what the evidence was that Cambridge had.
This is back to this, if you're done with that area, I want to get back to 102 and 195, and as I understand it, you know, answered it in this way because the court wanted to know if there were any potential issues of controversy. I guess when I look at this answer, I mean, why couldn't you have answered it in the negative?
I should
you know,
have, Your Honor.
Yeah, if the evidence was what you're telling us, that, you know, in the Johnson deposition, it was just his observation that he was acting. I mean, why wasn't it, if this was, I mean, why do you answer it this way? If there's
attorney error, Your Honor. I answered it the correct way in, I think it was paragraph 33, in reviewing what was done for me. I did not review it properly and changed the answers when I got to the other two. And it was, so it was something that was an error on my part. But getting beyond that, there's two things. Number one, the evidence itself does not support the so-called admission under the local rule. District court rule, and secondly, there was no material adverse employment consequence because there was never any change in pay to Josh Goad that was part of what they allege he was doing, which is acting as a team leader, even though he was never actually designated as a team leader. So there was no material adverse employment consequence for that. I have a few more minutes left, and I'd like to address briefly the whole issue of the other kinds of events that Mr. Johnson complains about. Most of those are a written warning that he received in February of 2000, a vacation warning.
What about that memo that all of a sudden appears rehearsing, you know, 9 months worth of, you know, or a mm-hmm. lengthy period of time worth of things, none of which sounded all that earth-shattering, you know, looking at them one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden it appears, and the EEO right. investigator seems to have been skeptical about it.
Yes, and in fact that was the only thing the EEOC was going to mediate over in the two charges. The rest of it they were going to dump in the discrimination claim. This is only the retaliation claim that they thought that was retaliatory. But the Seventh Circuit law is again clear that written warnings unaccompanied by any tangible adverse job consequence are not adverse employment actions. And so the truth of the matter is that if you look at what was in that February 2 of 2000 memo, it was a series of things that were sort of heightening, and you see that the timing of them was getting more rapid, of differences in conflict. And all they were saying is, Daryl, please behave on some things. If you take a look at what was in there, the timing is such that that's all they're trying to do is bring to his attention without any material adverse employment consequences, no suspension, no termination, no nothing. Just bring it to his attention so we have a better work environment. I see my time is up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll give Mr. Darst a full minute. I think he was eating into that last minute.
Thank you. Regardless of titles or pay or anything like that, the evidence from both sides shows that Josh Goad was acting as the team leader and performing those duties. A change of duties favorably is a for the person outside the class is an adverse action. The denial of those duties to the minority person is an adverse action.
We don't know if they were denied, though, do we?
Yes. And they were especially important to him because he kept asking for assistance, and he did not want to do those hard jobs which were injuring him and sending him to the hospital, and which they just required him to do because he was the only person who would get the job done. The whites would just stand around until he would do the job. So that's an adverse action. Lastly, at the end, after the harder jobs and the segregation and the taking away the promotion and all of that, then they make sure that he can never be promoted again because they write all these things at the very time after the EEOC notifies them of an on-site investigation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We will take this case under advisement.